I'm here today with Misha Glenny, a longtime BBC correspondent in Central Europe and the author in 2008 of McMafia, a best-selling book on organized global crime. His new book explores the threats of cybercrime, cyber warfare, and cyber-industrial espionage, and portrays the creation, the function, and the ultimate shutdown of the vast criminal website known as Dark Market. The book is appropriately entitled Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. Misha, the end of that title says, and you. That implies that this is a problem that affects every one of us. And in the book, you say it can no longer be swept under the carpet. Tell us about that.
Well, that's really because what you have seen over the past 10 to 15, 20 years is the development of an exceptional dependence on networked computer systems and the internet in every aspect of our lives, both in terms of the infrastructure of the countries we live in terms of, you know, how your water gets to you, how your electricity is delivered, that sort of thing, but also, of course, in your own personal life. I mean, one interesting thing is, I don't know if you've noticed, but we don't remember telephone numbers anymore. They're all in our contact books, in our phones. And if, of course, we've made the silly little mistake of failing to back up the data on our phones, we're lost because we can't tell, sometimes you can't even tell your own phone number anymore. So that's just a tiny example, but you can think about it in almost any aspect of your daily life. So with that, and given that each of us with our own devices, you know, and it used to be just one computer for the family, now we all have sort of three or four devices of our own. Each of those devices is a vulnerability, is a device which digitally can come under attack. So you have to know yourself. Let me give you a brief example. When cars became popular and a mass market commodity in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, if your car broke down, then the only person who would be inconvenienced by it would be you and your family and the person you were going to visit or you were going to see. If your computer is attacked and your computer comes under control of an organized crime syndicate or an intelligence agency, anyone who is creating these things called botnets, which are the amassed computing power of devices that have been infected, then you are contributing to malfeasance, to bad stuff on the web. And of course, you're also risking your own personal data. You have to get wise to the fact, otherwise you may find all your data splashed across the internet tomorrow for anyone to chew over as they will.
Misha, the Stuxnet computer virus that has targeted and disabled Iranian nuclear facilities seems to be a key component in the Western effort to keep Iran from possessing a nuclear weapon. So we can probably expect to see more of that kind of thing going forward. But its creation and its successful deployment has really upped the ante and carries huge risk, hasn't it?
Yes, of course, we don't yet have definitive proof, except for those people who actually developed and deployed it. We don't know who was responsible for the Stuxnet virus. We do know that it affected the two uranium enrichment facilities at Natanz and Bushehr, along with many other thousand Siemens systems, core industrial systems that the Stuxnet infected, but the aim was clearly to go for uranium enrichment facilities in Iran. Now, was it the Israelis? Was it the US? Was it, as a minority position holds, was it the Chinese who developed Stuxnet? We don't know for sure. We can sort of guess and extrapolate politically. In my opinion, it was probably the Israelis and or the US or the two in combination, some form of that. And it was clearly part of the attempts to disrupt Iranian nuclear development. Now, once that had happened, what was important about Stuxnet for me politically was that, first of all, a state or states invested a huge amount of time and money and investment in human investment in developing this thing. So it took months and months and months to develop. And then they deployed it. And by deploying it, and by you know, they must have been aware that it would have come out at some point that it was deployed. They were saying to the rest of the world, we've got these weapons and we're prepared to use them. And so what that did was, I mean, there were dozens of countries which already had nascent development capability of offensive cyber weaponry. But what the emergence of Stuxnet did was to accelerate those programs around the world. Basically, countries said, this stuff is out there. We've got to get engaged with this. And of course, the interesting thing about cyber offensive capability is there's a relatively low level of entry into that sort of thing. Anyone can start developing cyber weapons. It's not that difficult. Viruses are very easy to write. And so we now have this sort of cacophonous development in cyber warfare and cyber military, where people are making this stuff up outside of any international framework. There's no convention which regulates this stuff.
If that means that we have sort of a cyber arms race going on, is there yet any international consensus on how to control these arms and keep them out of the hands of the bad guys? Is there any kind of non-proliferation movement started yet in this area?
Well, there are what one could describe as talks about talks, really, but not much more than that. And that's because, you know, although the technology is the same, the interests which individual countries have invested in that technology and how it might develop are very, very different. So, for example, for the United States, the issue of intellectual copyright protection is extremely important. The piracy of Hollywood films and other creative industries, which are where the United States derives a lot of its money from, they want that to be at the top of the agenda of bad stuff that happens on the West. For the Chinese or for the Brazilians, they don't really care about that. They don't have a dog in that particular fight, and they don't see why they should invest money chasing the criminals who are making them in China and Brazil, when actually it's not really impacting on their society, as it were. So there you see, you know, a real problem about how do you regulate something when you're regulating different things, because the Chinese, of course, do regulate the internet, less to track down breaches of intellectual copyright and more to make sure that ordinary Chinese are not, you know, watching or listening to subversive political material on the web. So, you know, those interests don't coincide. And so that you see that in the sort of commercial and political sphere, but it applies to the criminal, it applies to industrial espionage, and it applies to military. So beginning to fashion even a sort of broad framework of what the discussion should be is proving very, very difficult, although attempts, as I say, are being made.
Misha, I want to go back to personal use and ask you, people who get reimbursed by their banks when their accounts are hacked or get made whole by their credit card companies when their cards are compromised, they can go away thinking that this is a victimless crime. Why would they be wrong to think that?
Well, you know, if it's quite a traumatic thing if you're internet, say, bank account has been hacked, because that usually assumes that somebody has been rifled through your computer itself and the data on your computer. So it depends what level that you're a victim of cybercrime. You know, if you can see that your data has been mined, that is very, very disturbing and upsetting, akin to a feeling of having your house broken into. But for most people, experience of cybercrime is, as you suggest, having your credit or debit card compromised. And as soon as that happens, you get a call from the bank who have, ironically, they have data systems which can spot unusual transactions. And they'll get in touch with you straight away and saying, you know, have you been spending a lot of money on spas in Tanzania recently? And you'll say, no, I've never been to Tanzania. That's all right. The bank will immediately say your card has been compromised, but don't worry. We have reimbursed the $1,600, which was a fraudulent payment from the Tanzanian spa, and you don't need to think about it. And of course, as a consumer and as an individual, you say, thank God for that. I'm not, you know, this is, whew, I've been let off here. Hooray! And although it's actually rather inconvenient than waiting for a new card to be issued, that's a side issue. But the question is, who is paying for that £1,600? Is the bank paying for that £1,600? My answer to that is probably not, given the reluctance that we know banks have for paying out for anything, and particularly if they've been up to no good themselves. But that, again, is a side issue. No, they get reimbursed by insurance companies, and the insurance companies then up the premium on the banks that they pay, and the banks pass those increased costs over to the consumer. So we are basically all paying for the cost of cybercrime, and those costs are rising steadily, particularly in the wake of the recession of 2008.
Talk a little bit about who the hackers are, what their motivations are. Are they criminals? Can you prosecute them as a way of curbing this misbehavior?
Some of them are criminals, some of them have been prosecuted, some of them are in jail. A lot of them have got away with it. Now, what can you do about hackers? Well, this is a very difficult question because people's motive for hacking varies tremendously. First of all, you have so-called white hat hackers, people who hack, but for what they consider to be ethically decent goals. Then you have groups like Anonymous, who hack for political reasons. They don't hack for financial gain. They hack to make a political point or to exact retribution, as they see it, on state or corporate entities which they feel are behaving unfairly. Then you have the criminal hackers. How do you differentiate between them? At the moment, we don't. At the moment, we see them all as hackers who have exceeded their authorized access and therefore are liable to times in prison. I think the time has come to have some more research into the characters of hackers. We know one or two things about hackers, for sure. One is that 95% of them are male, which tells you a great deal in itself. The other is that hackers, unlike people involved in traditional organized crime, if we're talking about criminal hackers, they don't need to deploy violence to get into the game. You know, you don't need a baseball bat to hack, which is, for me, very important because it attracts a different type of character. And those characters tend to be young, they tend to be gifted at maths, they tend to be poor socially in the outside world. But these are huge generalizations, and the reason why they're generalizations is we have come across these characters in courts, we've come across them, you know, in hacking forums and things like that, but nobody has yet invested the requisite research into what is a growing problem. We're now getting generations coming up for whom the internet is second nature, and as a consequence, we're getting a proliferation of hackers. We're not dealing with them. We're not looking into them. We see them just as criminals, regardless of what their motivation is. That has got to change.
Finally, what kind of man would hack into his own daughter's Facebook? Why did you do that, Misha, and has she forgiven you?
She's 19, and she's my daughter, and I had to hack into her Facebook account because she went missing. And it was the only way that we could track down, her mother and I, where she was. And her phone was turned off, and she was due to leave for the airport. Her mother was going to give her a lift a few hours later. And I just said, enough is enough. I need to know where she is. And so I hacked into her Facebook account, which would have been an illegal act here in the United States. Fortunately, I was in the UK at the time, and put out a message saying, where is she? This is her father. And we, as a consequence of that, we found her. So all was sorted out. She, of course, for 2 weeks wouldn't speak to me. And she wouldn't speak to me partly because she was very embarrassed, as well she might have been, and partly because she was furious with me for hacking into her Facebook account. And this is an interesting issue for children. It's really paradoxical, this. They'll put out any old rubbish about themselves, really the most appalling stuff on Facebook, and, you know, very, very personal and intimate stuff as well. But woe betide a parent who gets anywhere near their Facebook account.
Misha Glenny, thank you very much for talking with the Global Observatory.
Thank you.